Ellington is a name synonymous with music, with composing, arranging, and performing. There were not just one, but two iconic Ellingtons. There was the father and the son, but there was also their mistress, the music. This is the Jazz Scene, dedicated to the preservation, promotion, and appreciation of jazz, America's classical music. I'm Fred Macy. A few years ago, I had the privilege of visiting with Duke Ellington's son, Mercer, an accomplished musician and prolific composer in his own right. We sat down in the dining room of his Park Avenue apartment in Manhattan for nearly 2 hours with a big pot of coffee and a bigger stack of Danish. And we talked about everything from making music to his respectful but sometimes contentious relationship with his dad, the Duke. This is the second of three revealing parts. A unique view of a famous father through the eyes of his son, as he struggles to climb out of his father's giant shadow. Personal reflections of two legendary careers.
How would you describe the Duke as a person? If you stepped back and looked at him objectively, not as his son, what would you see?
Well, if you couldn't see it, but if you had the ability to actually know what it was his desire not to be comparable to anyone, nor anything that he did, to be able to be placed in parallel to someone else's work. Expression by many of his friends was that Ellington was beyond category. And
did he feel that way?
Yeah, he worked at it. He done, because I would sit there with him from time to time. He'd be in the process of writing something, and he'd play a portion of it. And he said, "Now hum the rest of that for me." And I'd sing what I heard or thought would be the continuation of it. He said, "Okay." Then when he finally did the tune, I said, "What happened to that section I hummed?" He said, "Well, that was what the average person would have thought of, so that's why I left it up." He wanted to make sure he went somewhere else.
You would see then somebody as a perfectionist, striving to be an individualist. Was he cynical? Was he an optimist?
No, he wasn't cynical, because first off, he was too religious to be cynical. He was an avid Christian. He was a sinner in part. He recognized that.
In what way?
Well, for instance, he loved ladies, and he was, in a sense, polygamous, at least to say his relationships with them. Mm-hmm. And according to some philosophy, is wrong. But this he felt was not necessarily his obligation. He felt love was more important, and the fact that he should do something for different people that was really constructive, and to be responsible to his family and to take care of their needs, which he always did. No one in our family ever suffered during his success.
Yeah, he always made sure the family was taken care of.
That's right.
But yet he remained kind of out here somewhere.
Well, it would seem that he was out there somewhere, but and maybe it's a disease or something's going wrong with me. But as the days go on, the things I used to accept as being fairly strange on his part begin to be very logical. And I don't know whether it's that I've developed or regressed.
Well, maybe you just start to understand a little more.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
What is it, with age comes wisdom, I hope.
Right, right.
What was his relationship like with the other musicians, other members of the band?
Well,
with Carney, with Strayhorn, with other people?
In those days, they used to compare the two bands, Cab Calloway's band and Ellington's band. And Cab was a strict disciplinarian. Everything happened at the right time and moment and so forth. And Ellington, it depends on when the band got there. All right. He wrote a whole tune because he was waiting for the musicians to come on, and he habitually had to do this. So every time they start a set, and if they were starting it with rocking and rhythm, he had to vamp on the piano till the band got in place. And that's how badly they were as far as being there on time is concerned. The tune he wrote eventually was called Kinda Dookies, but it went in front of Rockin' and Rhythm, and was waiting for Johnny Hodges and Jimmy Hamilton to get in place, and neither one of them would come because whoever gave way to that was more important. That was less important than the other. But in the final analysis, the person who had more control over every individual in that orchestra was Duke Ellington, not Cab. Ellington had sort of like shackles on these people psychologically. He knew where to get them, how to get them, and so forth, how to control them. It had to do with getting to them by assuring a man who probably consumed too much alcohol that the mortgage was always going to be paid on time, regardless of what he did with the money. He had an inside track on that man there, and this man had a weakness to do whatever his wife told him. That's the way Ellington would control that particular individual. Another one would like the importance of having to be addressed and placed into various conversations. And for every man in that band, whatever it was that helped give him a grasp over that particular individual, he had achieved.
So he was more of a psychologist than he was a disciplinarian.
Absolutely.
And with you, too, from the sound of things.
Oh, yeah. But yeah. You see, the only thing...
He was just flat out subtle, wasn't he?
Well, he had trouble with me because I went to the Army, and then when I came out, he gave me these two books. He said, read them and tell me what they're about. The books were on Schillinger, and there's no way in the world that you're going to take this mathematical description of what music is and develop it yourself. So I went to school on a GI Bill, went in there, and they said, okay, you can come here and study Schillinger if you want to, but you have to take two academic subjects while you're here. So I said, okay, anything. And I had taken most of the stuff they had down there, either in Columbia or Juilliard. So now I'm down at NYU, and I took something I had never really cared about and didn't care about at that point, because I said, the heck with it, as long as I get through here, I'll take anything just for the fun of it. And I took philosophy and psychology. Well, I used to go to school at 7 o'clock, and we had a family out in Queens. And it took like an hour and 15 minutes to come in by subway, an hour and 15 minutes to go back. And taking these classes 3 and 4 times a week, I had nothing else to do on the subway. I would read the book on the way to school, read the book on the way back. By the time I finished the course, I could tell the old man or the teacher the page that any subject was on and what the subject matter was about. So when he started with these arguments, and all, first off, I jump on him with, well, you're using an unfair method of argument.
So you kind of gained an upper hand.
And frustrate him to no end. I said, first off, you're talking too loud. And secondly, you've extended the argument. We started talking about man making $40 a week, and now you're talking about what he should do in the event that he gets sick and his hospitalization. That's not fair, because you're making me argue against something and forget what I started out with.
You were able to tell him that he wasn't psyching you anymore is what was happening.
Right. You read the 25 basic experiments of psychology, and you go through the whole bit. And he was furious, you know, and in his days, to get angry first meant to lose the argument. So I said, I won. I walk away from it. And we really got into some deals.
Mercer Ellington, as an artist, would you say Duke was a better composer or a better musician?
Well, he became a better composer and arranger. In the earlier days, he was a better piano player. He constantly challenged the real greats of the day. For instance, he used to sit up there and go after James P. Johnson or Willie the Lion, and he had no fear of sitting down and play solos behind those guys.
And just go for it. Yeah.
But as is the case with, I don't know exactly why this is, and in a sense I do, arrangers stop becoming great instrumentalists. And once in a while you get somebody, like you had Oliver Nelson in the old days, who was able to do both. But then I question the dexterity as to how creative their writing will remain if they keep themselves perfect on the instruments. Generally speaking, the minute a man turns more to composition and arranging, he becomes less involved in his ability to play, less dexterous.
Yeah, okay. He's just not spending as much time at it.
Right. Well, it's not only that, but I mean, you know, it's being a musician. It's also a matter of being an athlete. And
if you're going to be a way.
Yeah. Well, it's very simple. If you sit down on the keyboards and you try to play a number for 5 minutes straight and then go into your second chorus, you feel it.
Yeah.
unless your fingers are definitely developed. It's as if you and I, probably more like me, would just go out there today and walk 5 miles. You can't do it to just get up from here and go out. And the same thing is when you're blowing your horn or when you play piano. Play trumpet, for instance. It's a tremendous job. And this, of course, is the story of Cy Oliver. Cy was a great trumpet player. But at a certain point, he became much more successful with the things he wrote with Lunsford and gained an identity as an arranger and was called upon to do this more and more each time. And as a result, it wasn't until he got back to the Rainbow Grill, and then when he got up there, he was an average trumpet player. But in the earlier days, he was really something else.
Yeah, so it just kind of lose the lip a little bit and maybe not get it back or something.
Right, and the muscles that you develop in your fingers.
Was he a good musician?
Cy?
Duke.
Ellington? Yeah, he was the best. You know,
I know that sounds like a funny thing to say, but you know, having the band that he did and being so heavy into the composition, and as you say, you can lose your edge.
Well, the thing about certain people are, you know, some people are highly educated and they're still not good musicians because they get influenced by the fact that it's important to be acknowledged as being a musical doctor or being educated, having gone to certain schools and so forth. I'm not knocking the ability for a man to take a primary interest in the study of music rather than the performance of it. But if you're going to do the armchair business and you're not out there on the boards and paying your dues going up and down the road, you become a different kind of a musician. The idea of being a good musician or a bad musician lies within the man himself, not what he's doing and which part of the trade he's applying himself to. And some are just bad. I mean, which is what we are very concerned with, spoken about in the Bible. We have false prophets in high places. And they're just out there telling and thinking and saying some of the wrong things.
Yeah.
We have people who are inclined to want to play like Dizzy Gillespie or Old Matt Coleman or whatever. And they forget that these people were first solid, basic musicians before they went into the business of being mysterious and highly creative and advanced. This is true of Bartok and Schoenberg and the rest. Bartok has a book, and so does Schoenberg, on basic theory, which is like a little kindergarten book written for kids, telling you, you know, well, this is the way you approach this and that. But without the fundamentals, you can't go absolutely. I mean, there are people who can do it, but there are not that many geniuses who are able to go out and bypass a lot of the original stuff.
So you're saying Ellington mastered both?
Yeah, well, Ellington wrote
both,
the book.
Both sides.
As far as I'm concerned, he was the one that first came up with the saxophones, 5 saxophones on stage. He was the one who developed the growl sounds more so than anyone else. The one that put the drum in front as a solo instrument. He put the bass violin in front.
He experimented a lot.
Right, and he felt free and he had the confidence to go ahead and do these things which were accepted for years. And, you know, according to the old days, the instruments in the rhythm section were like kids. They were to be seen but not heard. So if this was something that could be violated, I even took great pleasure in doing it.
You think he did that more out of the way he was thinking as a composer or the way he was thinking as an artist? That is to say, let's try this. Was that out of something that came out of his head or off of his notepad?
No, he did it because he heard the man playing the instrument and felt that what he was doing was important enough to really be heard, and he should be in a position so he could be heard. So he put a microphone on the bass fiddle. Well, he'd had Sonny Greer with the band for years, and Sonny, for the time, was one of the greatest drummers in the business because he was a show drummer. When he ran into a sort of like a Renaissance period and wound up with Louis Belson, Sam Woodyard on drums, he felt they had something basic that had to be heard by the audience that was musical and very interesting and should be good for, you know, solo purposes.
Yeah. Which did he prefer to do? To write or perform, or did that feed a different side of him when he was on stage versus when he was composing?
I don't think he had a preference. I think that the two or even more facets of the business were all one to him.
He was in the music business, period.
Right, right.
Whatever it took.
When he told me about writing songs and so forth, he was telling me how to write the song, how to write the arrangement, and if we were going to do words or something to the song, that was the way you should approach it. In those days, you know, piano players all had to be vocalists, don't care where their voice was.
Yeah.
So he had some ears there where he did some singing, which is very little is known about, and there's only about two examples of it left.
Which are?
Well, one of them is The Saddest Tale, and then Moon Maiden is another tune he used to like to sing, but in those old days, he would do things like Sweet Lorraine or whatever, like just like that. Who else was a great singer at one stage of the game and then gave it up completely to Earl Garner?
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know. A couple of records of Earl singing.
Yeah, I never... Was Garner ever part of the band?
No, but I just named him as a typical example of what show business was and what it meant and what it indicated at certain points.
Duke wrote, when he wrote, according to his mood, that sort of set the tone for this song, but where did he get the actual inspiration? Once you had the mood, where did he draw from for some of the songs that he wrote? He had such a diverse...
There was no particular format. Sometimes, you know, people say, well, we want you to write a song for this occasion, such as, he would be given the job to write for a motion picture, like The Anatomy of a Murder and so forth. He was invited to do a work for the Harlem Dance Center, which would be completely his own. He also had record dates that he would have to make, well, what would seem to be a phenomenal number of tunes for one record when the long playing record came.
Yeah.
So he found out that he didn't quite have enough tunes to go along with it, and he'd force himself into creating a couple of tunes. But he never gave up the basic concept that the tune that comes to you on its own is the greatest inspiration. And he always had this tape recorder in his pocket or a pad and a pencil with him. So the least little thing that would come to him, he would save and not lose that particular thought or melody. And even now, once in a while, I lose something, and it's like being robbed, you know, because you had this treasure in your hands, and all of a sudden, it's gone.
You get it going around your head, and if it disappears, right, it's gone, period.
Right, and he was very much attuned to the fact that these great values would be at hand. They only came once. That, would be the major way in which he would go about getting material or writing for different occasions that he would reach back and get something that was an inspiration to him and then develop it into another work.
So he could write on demand,
right,
or at his leisure, either
right,
way.
Right.
You think of a single example of a tune that he had to write on demand, I mean, right now.
The River, which was written for American Ballet. This was done for Alvin Ailey, and he had to send in excerpts of it from time to time in order to meet the deadline for Alvin's creation of it.
Yeah. What did he consider his greatest work?
The song he's going to write tomorrow. And that was his absolute answer at all times.
That's fascinating. He had no special time or place or ritual or anything when he approached a song. I mean, he just, it might have been anywhere, anytime, any place.
It might have been at any time. Another work, which in a sense wrote itself, was the fact that he had met Dean Bartlett in Tanglewood, and the dean said, when you get to San Francisco, Tanglewood, of course, being in the Boston area, when you get to California, we'd like for you to come up to San Francisco and do a concert for Grace Cathedral. And by the way, would you please write a composition and dedicate it to the cathedral? So shortly after that, Ellington started writing this composition. By the time he got to San Francisco, it ran an hour and 20 minutes.
If it would have been a longer trip, it would have been a longer song.
Right, and it became known as the Sacred Concert, and it was his first church concert. He was to write two more after that.
Strayhorn was quite a composer in his own right, to say
absolutely
the least, as were
right
you.
Duke's been credited with something over 3,000 songs, give or take a couple of hundred probably. What was the relationship between Ellington and Strayhorn as composers?
Well, it was very kindred. It was almost like they were mental twins. And they would go on projects and write, and you couldn't tell where one ended and the other started. They would divide a project up into sections. And one would say, well, I'll take letters A and B, you take C, and then I'll take D, and so forth and so on. And one day, they got the name of the tune is Satin Doll. And they got their instructions mixed up. And they both did C.
Oh.
And when they came back, the two C's were exactly the same.
Really?
Yeah.
That's kindred.
Without having said one word about how it should be developed or who was to do it or what section would have it.
Man, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
There are those that say that Strayhorn was really the composer behind the composer. There are all kind of rumors
for instance, I can give you comparisons of where
Strayhorn did
various things. For instance, Duke Ellington wrote A Prelude to a Kiss first, and Strayhorn came behind and did an interpretation of that, which is called Passion Flower. The development and the structure of both tunes is almost exactly alike, and you can see where Strays had patented himself in a way after Ellington. For my money, Ellington was always a forerunner. The fact that Strayhorn was there was sort of like an impetus and a catalytic force that made Ellington write, made Ellington think a little bit more and reach a little harder, because Strayhorn, being as developed as he was, would be a little more difficult to dismay if he did some average thinking. So he used to outdo himself just to dismay Strayhorn at times.
Like a runner pacing himself.
Right, right.
He had Strayhorn nipping at his heels.
Right.
Got to stay ahead of this guy.
That's right.
How did Duke Ellington see his own music? How would he describe it? Was there a racial component to Ellington's music? How did his son finally come to terms with being in the shadow of his famous father? Don't miss part 3 of my interview with Mercer Ellington here at the Mark of Jazz. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with Mercer and his complete candor in sharing his story with us. If you'd like to hear something special, or maybe just want to talk about what it is you like best, be sure to leave me a comment either here at the Jazz Scene or on the website itself, markofjazz.com. Until next time, let me remind you of a bit of philosophy offered up by the great Miles Davis, who said, "Don't play what's there, play what's not there."